Israel's greatest period was the 10th century BC during the reigns of David and Solomon. It's true that the period in probably the 13th century under Moses was more formative for Israel. It's true that the most significant points in Israel's religious history, its history with God, were the covenants God made with Abraham and with Israel at Mount Sinai. But certainly from a political point of view, Israel's greatest period was when it was a genuine empire surrounded by subject peoples under David and then Solomon. And from the religious perspective, Israel remained more true to the Lord under David and in the earlier period of Solomon's reign than for centuries before or after. But sadly, neither the political greatness nor the religious loyalty to the Lord lasted long. In fact, both began to be eroded in the reign of Solomon. Solomon died in about 930 BC. What followed was the rebellion of Jeroboam. As we saw last week, Solomon was a great builder. He built, of course, the temple, and he built and fortified in many Israelite towns. It was all very magnificent, but there was a downside. His enormous building works had meant conscripting Israelites into forced labor. This was something that free-born Israelites accepted as the natural way to treat subject peoples, but which they deeply resented submitting to themselves. When Solomon died, therefore, and the Israelites came together at the old religious center of Shechem to make Rehoboam, Solomon's son, king, they first demanded that he, I quote, "lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke that he placed on us." Rehoboam asked for time to take advice. He rejected the advice of his older counselors, which was to win the people's confidence by making things easier for them, and listened to the advice of the younger men, who said that he would only be respected if he were firm. In the familiar words of the RSV, Rehoboam said, "My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions." The result was that most of the Israelites, all of the northern tribes, made a former officer of Solomon's, Jeroboam, their king. This whole story is in 1 Kings 12, 1-20. And the result was a permanent split, in which the old united kingdom of Saul, David, and Solomon divided into two, basically the pink and the green on this map, never to be reunited. Now, it's essential to understand this split, so let me put it in table form like this. The name of the southern kingdom was Judah, from which, incidentally, we get our word, Jews. The name of the northern kingdom was Israel. The name of Judah's first king was Rehoboam, Solomon's son. The name of Israel's first king was Jeroboam the First, who was not in any way related to David or to the royal family. The capital city of Judah was Jerusalem, which had, of course, been, that's Jerusalem there, had, of course, been the capital of the United Kingdom, not actually under Saul, but under David and then Solomon. The capital city of Israel moved about. Jeroboam I seems to have had it at the point place I pointed out to you a little time ago, Shechem, and then for most of the period of the northern kingdom's history, certainly from the time of King Omri in about 880 onwards, it was at, not very far away, at Samaria. The split was, as one might expect, along tribal lines. The tribes that constituted Judah, the southern kingdom, were principally the tribe of Judah itself, hence the name of the kingdom. Some of the tribe of Benjamin, which seems to have straddled the border here, and so been half in Judah and half in Israel. And most of the tribe of Levi, who provided the priests and temple servants of the Lord. Jeroboam stopped them from being involved in their religious duties, so that it was natural that those who lived in Israelite territory should now migrate to live in Judah, along with a number of lay people from different tribes, who, as 2 Chronicles 11:13 to 17 puts it, had set their hearts to seek the Lord God and couldn't stand what Jeroboam was doing to the religious practices of their native northern Israel. Finally, the main shrine or religious center of Judah was, of course, the temple in Jerusalem. And as it was essential for any kingdom to have its religious centers, so Jeroboam made them at Bethel in the south, right on the border with Judah, and at Dan, right up in the north of the kingdom of Israel. Now this leads us directly to the sins of Jeroboam, and here I'm going to ask you to turn to 1 Kings chapter 12. Okay, now this is such a crucial passage for the history of the northern kingdom that I want to read it to you, 1 Kings 12, 26 to 33. Then Jeroboam said to himself, "Now the kingdom may well revert to the house of David. If this people continues to go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, the heart of this people will turn again to their master, King Rehoboam of Judah. They will kill me and return to King Rehoboam of Judah." So the king took counsel and made two calves of gold. He said to the people, "You've gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." He set one in Bethel and the other he put in Dan. And this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one at Bethel and before the other as far as Dan. He also made houses on high places and appointed priests from among all the people who were not Levites. Jeroboam appointed a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the festival that was in Judah, and he offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. And he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places that he had made. He went up to the altar that he had made in Bethel on the 15th day in the 8th month, in the month that he alone had devised. He appointed a festival for the people of Israel, and he went up to the altar to offer incense. There was, as you can see here, a clear and compelling political reason for Jeroboam's actions. All Israel was required to go up to Jerusalem for the three annual festivals, though not all of the three may have been observed at this period. This would mean leaving the kingdom of Israel and going into the kingdom of Judah. What's more, the temple liturgies frequently celebrated the kingship of David and his successors. So Jeroboam was quite justified in his fear that the northern tribes might begin to transfer their allegiance back to Rehoboam, David's grandson. But the means he used were anathema to Orthodox Israel. He made two golden calves and said, verse 28, "Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." Now that's an important announcement. This was not full-scale paganism, the worship of calf gods. Jeroboam was not trying to abandon the formative Israelite traditions of Passover, Exodus, and the gift of the promised land. On the contrary, he was trying to claim these weighty traditions for his new religious shrines in Bethel and Dan. It's quite likely the case, even, that Jeroboam did not mean to say that the calves were gods, but rather that the calves were the mounts of their god. Certainly there's precedent for this in the depiction of Canaanite gods. And that the god seated or standing on the calf was the invisible Lord, the God of Israel. But if that is the case, it's easy to see how that distinction quickly became forgotten, and the calves were worshipped in their own right. I find this a particularly fascinating move because I happened, in a very exciting way for me, to be present in Dan when they were actually digging up the sanctuary which Jeroboam the First formed in Dan at the north of his kingdom. And the writer of 1 and 2 Kings regarded this as a most heinous sin. Further, verse 31 tells us that Jeroboam encouraged worship at high places. These were local shrines where the Lord God of Israel could be worshipped. Many of these sacred places, however, predated the arrival of Israel in Canaan. And so it's likely that there was a great admixture of pagan practices at them. And some of them were probably simply places of pagan worship. We think of this happening today in sub-Saharan Africa, where many peoples who've only accepted Christianity in the last two or three generations, or in this generation, mix their Christianity with pre-Christian religious and magic practices. Or in South America, where Roman Catholicism may be mixed with a great deal of superstition. But it's also, isn't it, very present in England today, where Glenn Hoddle can be called a born-again Christian and yet believe in the Hindu and Buddhist idea of reincarnation. Or regular churchgoers believe that Christianity is only one means of getting to God. And schools teach, at least by implication, that all religions have equally valid insight. Jeroboam also appointed non-Levites as priests in direct disobedience to the laws of God through Moses, and made a rival festival for Israel exactly 1 month later than the Jerusalem Feast of Booths to be a focus for the northern kingdom's worship and therefore still more keep them away from Jerusalem. All this completely convened the express commands of God through Moses and formed the basic pattern of Israel's religious life throughout its history, so that of almost every subsequent northern king, it is said, he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, walking in the way of Jeroboam and in the sin that he caused Israel to commit. Jeroboam and his successors not only sinned themselves, they led their northern subjects into sin. But there was still worse to come. And so I skip about 40 years to the sins of Ahab, whose dates are roughly 874 to 853 BC, and his wife Jezebel. And now I'd be grateful if you would turn on to 1 Kings chapter 16. Let me again read the opening words in 1 Kings of the description of Ahab's reign. Chapter 16, verses 29 to 33. In the 38th year of King Asa of Judah, Ahab son of Omri began to reign over Israel. Ahab son of Omri reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. Ahab son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. And as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam son of Nebat, he took as his wife Jezebel, daughter of King Ethbaal of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. Ahab also made a sacred pole. Ahab did more to provoke the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than had all the kings of Israel who were before him. Ahab did evil more than all who were before him. We're told it twice, in verse 30 and again in verse 33. First mentioned, and the root of much of the evil, was that he married the pagan Jezebel. She was not only a worshipper of the god Baal herself, but a zealous propagator of Baal worship. 1 Kings 21:25 says that she urged Ahab on to sin, so that, I quote, he sold himself to do what was evil in the sight of the Lord. She saw that the worship of the Lord, the God of Israel, was a threat to Baal worship, that the two simply could not exist together. And so she tried to exterminate the prophets of the Lord, and did in fact kill many of them. Ahab was the king, but at least from a religious point of view, Jezebel seems to have had him under her thumb. He worshipped Baal himself and built a temple to Baal in his capital city of Samaria, rather as if our queen had herself built the mosque in Regent's Park, or erected the great statue of the Buddha, which I must say I find offensive, on the banks of the Thames. And further, verse 33 tells us, he erected what is probably correctly translated a sacred pole, the symbol of the pagan goddess Asherah, who in Canaanite thought was the wife of the chief god and the mother of all the gods. This was considerably worse, of course, than what Jeroboam had done. It was not syncretism, that is, trying to worship the true God and mix in the thought, the practices, and perhaps the worship of other gods. It was wholesale rejection of the God of Israel and embracing full-blooded paganism, though Ahab himself might well have denied it. And this persisted throughout Ahab's reign and that of his son and successor Ahaziah. It was partly reversed by the next king, Jehoram, another son of Ahab's, but really stamped out by the king after that, Jehu, an over-fanatical adherent of the Lord, who made Samaria a bloodbath by gathering all the worshippers of Baal into Baal's temple, ostensibly for a great Baal service, and then murdering the lot and making the temple of Baal into a public loo. But even he didn't get rid of Jeroboam's golden calves. God, of course, did not stand idly by while all this was going on. And so we come to a section which I call the judgment and mercy of God. And since sin predominated in the northern kingdom, it's not surprising that we meet chiefly God's judgment. This came in two principal forms. There were internal enemies. Now, if I now put up the second overhead projector slide, this is the list of all the 19 kings of the Northern Kingdom. And you will see that there was constant coup and counter-coup. On this chart, a downward stroke means that the second king is the son of the previous king. An arrow across in either direction means that a new dynasty, a new line of kings, is begun. And as you will see, more often than not, there were only two kings of a dynasty before there's a conspiracy and a completely new line comes to the throne. Of the 19 kings, seven were murdered, and an eighth would have been, but he committed suicide first. The only line that established itself for a considerable time was the house of Jehu, and this was God's promise to him, 1 Kings 10:30, because despite his bloodthirstiness, he did genuinely want to see the Lord honored in Israel. Incidentally, the numbers of years that each king reigned is set down on this list precisely as they appear in 1 and 2 Kings, because our way of reckoning years is somewhat different, and because some of them were probably co-rulers with their fathers, their actual reigns, by our standards, were in several cases substantially shorter. But this experience of the Northern Kingdom was quite unlike Judah, which with one brief exception had consistently kings of the Davidic dynasty on the throne. In other words, direct descendants of David throughout this period and indeed after the fall of the Northern Kingdom. But 1 and 2 Kings are absolutely clear that this series of revolutions was God's punishment on the Northern Kings for sinning and causing Israel to sin. God announced this through prophets. For example, he told Ahijah, the same prophet who had announced that Jeroboam the first would become king, to tell Jeroboam's wife, "I will cut off from Jeroboam every male, both bond and free in Israel. Moreover, the Lord will raise up for himself a new king over Israel." But the Israelites' enemies were not only internal, they were also external. At this time, when a European capital is being bombed for the first time since 1945, we need to remember that war was commonplace in ancient times, and indeed almost everywhere until this century. The story of David's adultery with Bathsheba begins in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle. That's 2 Samuel 11:1. So Israel fought many wars with many of the surrounding kingdoms. But broadly we can say that Israel's principal enemies were first Judah, the pink on this map, especially immediately after the breakup of the United Kingdom, from 930 to about 880 BC. Then Syria, this yellow part up here, the top right-hand corner, or as it's normally called in the Bible, Aram, with its capital in Damascus, especially in the period 880 to 740, and finally, Assyria, and for that I have to go to this map, I'm sorry if you can't see it down here, but here is Israel up here, obviously tiny in this much larger map, and this is the Assyrian heartland over here, although it became an enormous empire, first of all the part in darker green, and then the part in lighter green, and subsequently, actually at the end, even taking in all of Egypt as well. Absolutely gigantic empire. And that was from 740 to the end of the Northern Kingdom in 722. And the books of Kings are very clear. When Israel was defeated in judgment, in battle, it was God's judgment on her sins. So as one example, in the reign of Jehu's son, Jehoahaz, 2 Kings 13:3 tells us, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, so that he gave them repeatedly into the hand of King Hazael of Aram. And sometimes Israel was reduced to a shadow of its former self, with much of its land captured, while at other times it was strong and victorious. And this leads us to God's mercy. God was not specifically committed to any of the kings or any of the lines of kings of the Northern Kingdom. It's true that he might send, frequently did, a prophet to announce that somebody would be the next king or even to anoint them king, but there was no covenant between the kings of Israel and God, as there was, of course, with the Davidic kings of Judah, because God had promised David, you remember, via the prophet Nathan, your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. 2 Samuel 7:16. But God never forgot his covenant with Abraham, the ancestor just as much of the northern tribes as of Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. So when 2 Kings 13:22 and 23 have announced the constant attacks of King Hazael of Aram, they add, but the Lord was gracious to Israel and had compassion on them. He turned towards them because of his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he would not destroy them. It was his commitment to this covenant with Abraham that made God delay and delay again the final destruction that Israel's apostasy deserved. But after so many warnings from Moses' day onwards, and so much disobedience on Israel's part, it was inevitable that the end came to Israel. I got about a page left. Whoever's doing their coffee. Israel was a minor power caught between two major powers. Egypt, to the south and west, and some empire in Mesopotamia, to the north and east. Which empire was in the ascendant changed. For most of the period from Joshua's day to the 8th century, these superpowers were in comparative decline. It was because Egypt was relatively weak that Israel had been able to conquer and occupy the promised land, which had traditionally been Egypt's sphere of influence. It was because for much of this period there was no clear Mesopotamian superpower that Israel's principal enemies were ones of roughly the same size as herself, which she could cope with much of the time, Judah and Syria. But now, Assyria had grown much stronger. And under her great king, Tiglath-Pileser III, whose dates are 745 to 727 BC, and who's sometimes known in the Bible by his Babylonian throne name of Pul, Assyria reached the zenith of her power, or at least the zenith of her power to date, and menaced Palestine in earnest. The upshot was that Assyria, under Tiglath-Pileser III's successor, Shalmaneser V, obliterated Israel. God's patience had at last run out. As 2 Kings 17:18 puts it, the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them out of his sight. None was left but the tribe of Judah alone. The capital Samaria was besieged and taken. Other towns and villages had already been destroyed, and many Israelites were taken into exile. Assyria then peopled the land of the northern kingdom with pagans from other conquered territories who worshipped their own gods as well as adopting the worship of the Lord, in other words, the worship of the God of the territory they'd come to. It's for this reason that we find New Testament Jews despising Samaritans. They were considered to be debased in blood because they'd intermarried with the foreigners Assyria had brought in, and debased in religion because although by Jesus' day they had shed the pagan admixture, they had beliefs which mainstream Judaism repudiated. For instance, you remember this from the so-called woman at the well, that worship of the Lord should take place at Mount Gerizim, which is here, near Shechem, and not in Jerusalem. And so the history of Israel, the northern kingdom, comes tragically to an end, reminding us that God does not spare even his own people. I have often wondered how long God will continue his patience towards Britain with our widespread rejection of Christ and his lordship and our sexual practices that are all too reminiscent of those of Canaan.